Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. We'll have the latest on the attack in Manchester, England. We'll be in depth on how couples share power. But first, to our Tuesday voice from the opinion pages, Robert Mary argues on the American Conservative website that impeaching or somehow removing President Trump from power will not resolve the crisis that the U.S. confronts. Mr. Mary is the editor of the American Conservative. He has a forthcoming book about President McKinley in the fall. He joins us from Washington today. Robert Mary, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Carrie. It's great to be with you.
You say that what ails America isn't the fact of Donald Trump in the White House. He's a symptom of a larger problem. What's the problem?
Well, I do say also that Donald Trump is becoming its own crisis, but there's an underlying crisis. And I think the underlying crisis is what I call the crisis of the elites. I think that the elites of America have let America down, and I think the American people sense that. They feel that they have been let down, and that's one of the reasons why Donald Trump was elected, I think probably the major reason. We can settle the Donald Trump crisis, which has to do with this investigation over any collusion with Russia, et cetera, or his erratic behavior, but the underlying crisis isn't going to go away as a result of that.
Let Americans down how?
Well, in a lot of ways, we have the hollowing out of the American working class, the middle class of America. That's a terrible thing. We have a situation with immigration in which we have 11 million illegals in the United States, which is a significant breach of border security and American sovereignty, and the elites of America allowed it to happen. And I argue in this piece that leaving aside the merits of the case, you have people who say this is essentially good for America, and then you have other people say that it's not good for economic reasons and maybe for reasons having to do with the erosion of our cultural heritage. But leave that aside for the moment. The fact of the matter is that when you have this kind of a policy with this kind of a result, you inevitably drive a wedge through America, through the American polity. And the elites of America let that happen. They shouldn't have let that happen.
I think it would be useful if we defined how you're thinking of elites. I mean, are we talking about our political leadership, our academic leaders, professional elite? Who are these people?
Well, certainly we're talking about the political elites, but I think we're also talking about the financial elites, the big banks of Wall Street generally, which is have extremely cozy relationship with the federal government and the Fed. My friend David M. Smick, who's the author of a fine new book, he's an economist and an international economic consultant, and he wrote a book called I can't remember the title right now, but what he said was that after the Great Recession, the Great Equalizer, it's called, after the Great Recession, the solutions to that problem, in which we sort of bucked up these big banks that, mm-hmm. that were contributory, constituted, he said, the greatest transfer of wealth from the middle class to the elites, the financial elites, in the history of the world. Well, that's the kind of thing that generates political reaction, and I'm saying that the political reaction ended up being the election of Donald Trump.
I was struck by something that you said about Republican voters and Trump. You write that Republicans, many of whom resisted Trump for a long time, finally gave way, and quote from your piece, because Republican voters fundamentally favor vulgar, ill-mannered, tawdry politicians? No. Because the elite-generated society of America had become so bad in their view that they turned to the man who most clamorously rebelled against it. What you didn't add there is that if anybody is the personification of elite, it's Donald Trump. How is it that he managed to be an elite and not seem like an elite to the voters who supported him?
Well, being a billionaire, he is sort of in that category, and yet he put himself forward as a man who was going to run against all of these forces that I'm talking about. He's not governing that way, by the way. I think that Ross Douthat in the New York Times was saying on Sunday, he's basically turned his back on many of the people that he was trying to bring into his fold when he was running for president. But nevertheless, that's he was able to do that because the American people, many of them, not all, certainly a minority actually in his case, were receptive to that message, largely because they felt that the country is on the wrong track. And that right track, wrong track poll question is very, very significant in determining the mood of the electorate. And the mood of the electorate was very surly. It was not just manifest in Trump. It was also manifest in Bernie Sanders.
You know, we don't know where the economy is headed here. But at the moment, President Trump is benefiting from a pretty strong economy, which allows him to go out and say, we're creating jobs and I'm, you know, striking down trade agreements. What is it that you would say he is not governing as that some of these American voters who supported him, who are part of this group that you feel like has been on the wrong side of the economic recovery, that he's not supplying to them? Because right now it looks like he's delivering much of what these people wanted.
Well, I wrote a book on the American presidency some years ago called Where They Stand, about how presidents fail and succeed and how we assess their performance in history. And in that book, I make it very clear that we assess our presidents in four-year increments. We look at their term, the first term, and if it's good, they get reelected, and then we look at their second term. And if it's good, then the party stays in power. If not, it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So Trump has plenty of time to establish whether he's going to be a successful president or not. And I don't think that the American people are making a hasty judgment on that question. They're waiting and seeing, which is a right thing to do.
Well,
but the question really has to do with what he campaigned on,
right,
and what he's doing.
Right.
So if you take just as one example foreign policy, in going after George W. Bush in a very, very strident manner about Iraq and indicating that he was not going to get us into anything approaching that, he wasn't going to be involved in sending the military out into the Middle East in the same way. He's not governed that way at all. He's supporting Saudi Arabia in its war against Yemen, which is a horrendous thing. He's cozying up to Saudi Arabia and the Sunnis generally, who are not that far removed from some of the Sunni terrorism that he decries. So that's just one example in which he's not governing as he ran.
Then that's a really interesting point, because I think we've got a lot of examples where he said he was going to do one thing and has now said, I mean, on some of the trade agreements, right? He said he was going to end NAFTA.
Example.
Right.
He talked big about that.
Right.
And maybe too big. He was too much of a protectionist. And probably there's a balance between the old free trade mantra that has been guiding us for quite some time now, and maybe some alterations on that and some tweaking. But he's not really moved very far beyond the policies of his predecessors in terms of trade.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about, Robert, that, I mean, he seems to still be able. Now I'm not ignoring his low approval ratings, but he still has that very solid base. And as you say, it's early days yet. But he seems to be able to say, well, I've got new information about fill in the blank, NAFTA, immigration, you know, go down the list. And now I've rethought that, and the base doesn't seem to be bothered by that.
Well, I think you see this in any president. The base gives the president, it's the base is his strongest support. So the base is going to give him the longest period of time to demonstrate what he can do or can't do. So I'm not really surprised about that. I think that the big question is, as we sit here and triangulate as analysts or journalists or, you know, radio announcers or editors like myself, we can sort of look ahead and get a sense of what it appears. And what I'm seeing is that he is not running as he ran. He's not governing as he ran. And that could ultimately get him in trouble with the base. As you say, he's not there yet.
I was interested to see that you've got this book coming out about President McKinley. Tell me one fact that most Americans don't know about President McKinley.
Well, I don't think most Americans know that McKinley was, as the subtitle of my book says, the architect of the American century. He basically set America on course. He made America an empire, and he did it in about 3 months in the Spanish-American War, where we basically kicked Spain out of the Caribbean. We turned the Caribbean into an American lake. We acquired Hawaii. That wasn't related to the war, but it came at the same time. We acquired Puerto Rico. We acquired the Philippines. We acquired Guam. We had coaling stations all over. He built up the Navy, which had been happening already and was carried further with his successor, Teddy Roosevelt. He established the special relationship with Britain, a relationship that had been tattered before his presidency. He created the open door to China. All kinds of these things were happening, and he doesn't get credit for it.
So he was a busy man.
Well, that's not fair. I think we ought to give the guy some credit. So, and I'll say, if I have time, I'll just say one other thing. He had a wonderful relationship with his wife, who was described as an invalid. She was infirm in many ways, both psychologically and physically, and he was constantly attentive to her throughout his life and his busy career. So he gets credit for that, too.
Robert, thank you. Good to have you on the show. I hope you'll come back.
I will. My pleasure.
Robert Mary is the editor of The American Conservative, and his forthcoming book about President McKinley is going to be published in the fall.
Looking for a new podcast? I'm Tracy Mumford, a producer for NPR News. I'm part of the team working on 74 Seconds. It's a new podcast that looks at the shooting death of Philando Castile by Officer Geronimo Yanez. It happened last summer in Falcon Heights, Minnesota. Yanez is now facing charges in Castile's death. 74 Seconds looks at what happened that night and what happens now when a police officer goes on trial. Reporters John Collins and Reham Fashir will walk you through this case as it unfolds. It's a story about race, policing, and justice in America. Subscribe to 74 Seconds wherever you get your podcasts.